This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 60 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max.
Hi, David. Are you doing anything, interesting this week?
You're gonna make me spill the beans. Well, actually, when people hear this, it will have probably already happened that I got to go fly with the Blue Angels and the Geico Skytypers. So hopefully tomorrow, as I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to make this happen, we'll have a really good weather, really calm day, and I will get some amazing photographs of 8 aircraft flying in formation together. So, but they're not UAVs, so I get, and they will be manned. So I guess we should talk about the unmanned vehicles.
All right, what have we got for this episode, David?
Well, we got some good news. A COA was granted to Texas Equisearch to do a search and rescue mission. Reno is not just manned aircraft anymore, and that would be the Reno Air Races. The Chinese are now big in inflatable UAVs. And Max, we've come to the conclusion we have two new segments. The first one will be This Week in Regulation, since we talk about it every week. And the other one is more along the lines, and we're calling that Grounded Due to Bad Behavior.
Yeah, these things just keep coming up, don't they?
Yep. Then we've got a DJI Phantom that went swimming for the video of the week. So we got a lot to talk about and a lot of listener mail, so we better get started. Well, our first story is actually good news. After Texas Equisearch had sued the FAA to be able to use drones in missing persons cases, this week the FAA granted an emergency COA to utilize unmanned aircraft system in the search of a missing woman in Texas.
The FAA says that they granted that in less than 24 hours. Yay. Interestingly enough, the COA was not really granted to Texas Equisearch. It was granted to the National Institute of Standards and Technology of Gaithersburg, Maryland. And under a emergency COA, the operator, NIST in this case, was allowed to utilize a subcontractor, that being Texas Equisearch, for a very specified period of time. It was very, very limited, wasn't it, David?
Yeah, actually, it was September 11, 2014 to last Monday, which was September 15th. So the FAA saying, yeah, go ahead, but it's not an open-ended thing, and which I'm not in disagreement of. It's an emergency certificate of author, and it's an emergency power, and therefore it needs to be temporary. So good for the FAA. I'll give him points on this one.
Now, in the FAA press release, I guess, they say that COAs on an emergency basis are issued when three conditions are met. One is a situation exists in which there is distress or urgency, and there is an extreme possibility of a loss of life. Okay, that sounds good. Second one is the proponent has determined that manned flight operations cannot be conducted efficiently. Okay, I can get that. And the third one, the proposed UAS is operating under a current approved COA for a different purpose or location. Interesting. Different purpose or location. So that's why we have the NIST here. It's just very kind of strange, David, that a sort of a middleman has to be involved in this.
Well, we know that NIST in Gaithersburg was part of the test site for the Maryland, New Jersey, and Virginia. So they have a COA to operate their aircraft. Therefore, they're using their aircraft, which they have a regular COA to fly in the test area, to use that aircraft, which the FAA, I guess, considers certified, to be used in Texas under Texas Air. So it's interesting that they're putting levels of security in. Well, we've already authorized A, so you can use A, but don't go out and try to use B in this certificate of authority. So it makes sense. It's kind of bureaucratic, but it does make sense.
It is a bit bureaucratic, but they used an MLB Superbat, which is a fixed wing. It has a 8.5 roughly foot wingspans powered by a little 50cc 4-horsepower two-stroke engine, but it has a 10-hour maximum or up to 10-hour maximum flight duration, which is kind of what you want for search and rescue, I think. You don't want to have to come back every 15 minutes to replace the batteries. Telemetry range of up to 10 miles, and interestingly, it's launched by a catapult. It turns out that they did not find the woman. The search has been subsequently suspended until more leads can be developed. So I guess they're maybe taking a step back and looking at how they want to conduct the search or what needs to happen next in terms of finding this woman. So, yeah, the bottom line is we had a case where we really needed to get a drone up in the air, and we were able to, and the FAA allowed that. So that's, yeah, that, as you said, David, that's really good news.
Yeah. So let's go a little different. We'll move from Texas to Reno, Nevada. The Reno Air Races draw a new kind of aircraft, drones. And this was from thedailynews.com, and it was actually an Associated Press story. This year's National Championship Air Races in Reno, which concluded last weekend, included a small UAS challenge.
Yeah, and this was a challenge that they were looking to test speed, agility, and strength. And it included an obstacle course and a time trial and, I guess, a deadlift as well. Competitors were limited in what they could fly, could be no bigger than 36 inches, a maximum of 10 pounds, and it had to take off and land vertically. So, yeah, as you say, David, the competition, I've been searching the news reports to see if there's any results from the competition, but so far haven't seen anything. We did try to reach out to some folks who were there and see if we could get a firsthand report, but we haven't been able to do that yet. One interesting thing is they set up something that they called the Drone Zone, that included a number of exhibitors, and I think it was kind of a little area where people who are attending the air races could maybe get up close and see some unmanned aerial vehicles and probably develop more of an awareness and understanding for what these things are. And I like that idea a lot.
Well, yeah, and we also had that at the in Cleveland this year.
Right.
They actually, where they had a drone area set up. So we definitely want to keep getting the word out. And this is one great way of doing it. The National Air Races, of course, are where speed and technology come together and they get thrown into World War II aircraft. But now it's a lot of jet racing. So it'll be interesting to see if at some point we have an unlimited UAV race.
I think kind of the idea is that this is sort of a preliminary kind of a competition in advance of maybe some future competition, like you say, David, where it's a more heavy duty, stressful kind of a competition. One that really shows off the capabilities of not only UAVs, but the pilots that direct them around a course. So, yeah, I hope this went well, and I hope that this will lead to some, increased awareness, but also some increased competition, which also drives awareness, and that's always good.
So you're the expert on the next country, having been there. Why don't you start off with the next story?
Ah, from James. We have a couple of articles.
See, I wouldn't even known how. Oh, well, I know how to pronounce James, but the first word in the title, I was not going to be able to pronounce.
Oh, Tianjin. This is the Tianjin Expo reveals Chinese UAV innovations and aspirations. So we just had the Tianjin International UAV and Model Aircraft Technology Exhibition. And in that event, there were some interesting things shown. One is, well, this is an inflatable UAV. Now, this is a guy, he's 69 years old, and he's been working on designs as an engineer, university engineer for a number of years. And he showed three variants, the SF1, SF2, and SF3. And these things have wingspans of respectively 2.5 meters, 3 meters, 4.3 meters. They have a useful load of around 25 kilograms, range about 100 kilometers. And what these things do is they are actually inflatable. And they have an electric motor, kind of the landing gear that you might expect. But, I mean, this is kind of an interesting kind of a concept. It's kind of one way to get, you know, a flyable aircraft together without the complexity that you might find in a, you know, more conventionally constructed aircraft. Although, David, it is still kind of bizarre to get my, you know, to get your head wrapped around a inflatable UAV.
Yeah, but if we go back in time, historian alert, if you go back in time, the Goodyear company had the Inflataplane, which was a single man inflatable aircraft with a small motor that the Army wanted to be able to backpack and use as an observation aircraft. They'd blow it up, they would take off. So yeah, if you Google Goodyear Inflataplane, and we'll put, I'm sure, a link in the show notes for it, it's old technology, folks. It's just being done differently. Everything that's old is new eventually comes around again, huh?
Yeah, for sure. There's also an article in the Daily Mail about these inflatable drones in China. And in this article, they're talking about speeds of 120 miles an hour, which seems kind of amazing for an inflatable vehicle. But again, you know, maybe these things are initially expensive as they're developed, but you know, maybe it's a way to get ultimately to get lower cost UAVs into the hands of people who could, you know, use them for productive purposes. So yeah, it's something to keep an eye on, I think. And as we know, the Chinese are very, very interested in developing an aviation industry, an indigenous aviation industry, and we see them making all kinds of inroads and activities, both in general aviation and in commercial aviation as well. And so here we see them also trying some things in the UAV world. Don't take your eyes off China.
Yeah, you keep saying that. You always say that on Airplane Geeks too.
I know. But we've got an item from Europe now, moving around the globe a bit.
Yeah, well, we're going to start calling this segment the This Week in Regulation, because it always seems like we talk about regulations everywhere, and this was from AIN Online. Matthew Baldwin, the Director of Aviation and International Transport Affairs with the European Commission, the EC, has some comments from the UAS 2014 conference held in London. Now, folks, we'd like to go to the UAS conference held in London in 2015. So become a patron of UAV Digest so we can go next year and cover it in person. But Matthew's comment was, the task of creating regulatory framework that promotes UAS but addresses safety and privacy concerns. Well, that's, as usual, stating the obvious. We want them to use them, but be safe. And the biggest takeaway, though, was the EU has got a bit of a problem where a lot of the countries are setting up their own regulations and there's no real standardization. And the EU, the European Union, is supposed to be one of those overarching things. And this is precisely one of those things that they should be looking at. But right now they're trying to combine all of everyone's regulations and they're having problems.
He mentions that as an example of this is thresholds for UAV classifications based on weight. And he says they're inconsistent across the EU member countries. He goes farther and says that they're kind of absurd and arbitrary. But it's an example of how there needs to be some commonality across them. He also says that that he believes that the EASA, the European Aviation Safety Agency, is best placed to develop rules. And he says he envisions that an EC proposal early next year will cover the safety, liability, insurance, and security, privacy, and so on. So we look forward to that.
You think, Max, in 2015, we're going to have lots and lots of things to talk about? Because everybody says, oh, in 2015, we'll have the regulations set up. In the beginning of 2015, or in late 2015, or, you know, 2015 is going to be a big year, and $5 says nothing happens.
Oh, you're predicting everyone's going to be a little delayed. Is that it, David?
It'll be next year in 2016.
Yeah. Well, that's how these things seem to go often.
All right. I don't even know. I don't have a bridge into this next story.
There is no bridge, David, to this next story. It's impossible. But this is how we heard from a couple of listeners, Bill and Chris, for example, on this. This was a story I had to tell my wife today as we were going for our walk. It's interesting. It's hysterical. And I'm pretty sure it's true.
The technology websites picked this up before everybody, and the two headlines, and I'm going to try to read this with a straight face, is researchers seek permission to collect whale snot with drones, or this dunkable drone will suck up whale snot for science. Evidently, snot has become a scientific term. Whales have blow horns that are aligned with mucus. Research want to collect the mucus to determine the health of the whale.
And whale mucus, as you might think, is not an easy stuff to collect, is it? You can't keep a straight face, can you?
No, it's either that or nausea. I'm not quite sure. Basically, the drone is going to hover over the excrement and harvest it and bring it back to researchers.
This is something that the Olin College of Engineering has been working on. The best part of the story is what they call this quadcopter that's going to collect the whale mucus. Did you want to say it, David, or should I go ahead?
Oh, go ahead.
So this is the Snotbot, and I think that's perfect. So the idea is this thing hovers over the blowholes, and it uses, sponges to soak up the mucus, and then presumably return that back to the researchers who can do their analysis.
happily study it. You know, and the worst part about this was now we have to wait for the FAA to give permission to this organization to collect the snot. And my other thought was, what would Jacques Cousteau say? You know, We enter the water, we search the whales, we send the UAV over, you know, in my bad, you know, the man flew a Catalina, granted, okay, let's just move on. Folks, just read the stories and you'll understand. So our next segment we're now calling Grounded Due to Bad Behavior, because basically, like regulations, it seems like every week now we have people going, I didn't know I couldn't do that with a UAV, and have the nerve to look surprised. So our first story was from WQAM.com, and it was sent in by our listener, Mark Labrowski. And evidently at Nashville International Airport, the pilot of an American Eagle flight spotted a hovering drone. The ATC notified the police air unit, and the FAA is investigating. Okay, folks, we all know this is really stupid.
This is a bad one. I mean, near an airport? Oh, my gosh. You know, it speaks, once again, to the issue that, you know, you have hobbyists probably who are just unaware, right? They just have no awareness. Maybe you can't blame them because they've never encountered any kind of activity associated with aviation in the past, but they can get onto Amazon and order themselves a pretty capable little device that takes amazing videos. And so off they run. There needs to be some awareness. There needs to be something. I mean, every other product you buy comes with pages and pages of
warning labels in Chinese.
Yeah. So we need something like that here, but it needs to be effective.
Oh, boy, you are demanding, aren't you? You want warning labels and them to be effective. Boy, you are spoken like a true engineer.
What's going to happen, especially in this country, I predict, is somebody's going to do something really stupid. Someone's going to get hurt. And then there's going to be a lawsuit. And, you know, when there's a lawsuit, who do you go after? You go after the deep pockets. And is that going to be the pilot some guy, or is it going to be the manufacturer of the drone? Who do you think has deeper pockets? I hope it doesn't come down to that before the manufacturers or the industry realizes that, just waiting for the FAA to develop regulations is not good enough. It's just not good enough. But anyway, so there's my soapbox. That's our first bad behavior example. But we have another one, don't we, David?
Yeah, and this one, we've talked about flying stupidly. This one is being stupid in a violation of privacy. And this one was from 13wham.com, which I'm assuming WHAM is a television station or radio station, and drones snooping into homes. Evidently, the ABC affiliate in Rochester is saying there's a lot of people seeing drones spying in their windows. One woman says she says her son had friends over for a pool party, and suddenly a drone was hovering overhead. This isn't good either.
No. And apparently in this neighborhood, there have been some others who've reported seeing some kind of a drone flying around, flashing red and green lights, and they've seen this after dark. When these things happen, they want to take some action. So here we see the town supervisor for this particular town has said some towns have adopted regulations. I have our town attorney looking at that as a possibility. Maybe we will adopt an ordinance that makes it illegal to do this. So politicians want to react to the constituents who have problems, and in this case, they're having privacy issues. And this is the way you get this sort of patchwork of bad ordinances, regulations, laws, and things, is if everybody does this on their own.
Yeah, that's unfortunate because people are being stupid. So what have we learned tonight, folks, fly your drone safely, and that's not near an airport. And two, don't fly it over your neighbor's pool to videotape them. But let's move on to more positive news, and I'm sure we'll have more stories next week. So don't forget, feedback@theUAVDigest. If you have a bad news, they need to be grounded story, send it to us. But our friend Max Trescott, our co-host on Airplane Geeks, at least temporarily this summer, sent us a clip from Jimmy Fallon, huh?
This is Keep an Eye on Battery Life, and we'll put a link to the YouTube video in the show notes. This is kind of fun. What we see is a DJI Phantom that's being flown. It looks like some kind of waterfront property. And what are they going to do? They're going to fly the Phantom up over the water and get some great shots of the property. Just one little problem.
Yeah, the one little problem was it ran out of power.
And so what happens? Well, they descend, of course. So in the midst of this, you see what turns out to be the pilot come running across the ground there into the water and desperately trying to get to the Phantom before it becomes submerged. Yeah. And he catches it. He does. He catches it kind of at the last minute. So a close call.
But the next story isn't so good. This was from Neil Clary, and again, it's YouTube. It's a DJI Phantom and GoPro 3 Black go for a swim. This is a pretty spectacular video. A gentleman landed a helicopter in the middle of Tingle Lake in British Columbia.
On a rock.
On a rock. It's a spectacular piece of flying.
It's a small rock. It's not much bigger than the helicopter.
The helicopter. And then they take their little canoes across the shore to the shore, and they videotape it. And the Robinson R44 looks awesome and this beautiful lake. But unfortunately, at some point, and it doesn't really explain what happens, but they lose control of the DJI Phantom and it goes right into the drink. Now, the best part about this whole video is the GoPro never stops running. So you get to watch the DJI Phantom sink on camera as the GoPro falls gently to the bottom of this lake. Though we will warn you, there is some swearing involved when the DJI Phantom decides to go for its swim. So if you got little kids around, probably not want to watch this, or do not. It's I forget what my friend calls it, not office worthy, but it's a brilliant video. And I like the little tag at the end of the video towards the DJI Phantom. And it's definitely fun and really pretty. And it is kind of amazing what a GoPro can do.
All right. Well, let's see, David, I think it's time for a little bit of listener feedback.
The first one was from Eric. Really enjoy your podcast. Thank you for your time and effort in putting it together. Luckily, we do this in our spare time. And he's been flying a quadcopter for nearly a year now. My interpretation of the FAA regs was defined in the roadmap as UAs do not include balloons or tethered aircraft. And Eric was interested because he flies his UAV tethered. Does that mean he's off the hook with the FAA? And this is one of those, I'm requesting everybody to do a double shot because of the FAA, because a miracle occurred. Didn't it, Max?
Well, yeah. And this is a question that's come up among some others, is if you take your UAV and tether it with a line of some sort, does that absolve you from the prohibitions on use? And Eric asked the FAA, he asked them specifically, he says, does the FAA have any guidelines in regards to tethered aircraft? And he got an answer.
And that's why you need to do a double shot.
Yeah, right. Okay, because they answered him. And the FAA's response was, the short answer is no. He says, we have looked at tethered UAS a couple of years ago. The story is we thought they could be considered like a kite or moored balloon covered under 14 CFR Part 101. The FAA says there was an internal discussion and our lawyers weighed in and deemed them aircraft, tethered or not. Tethering is merely a very good safety mitigation. Since they are
I like that a lot. It's a safety mitigation.
It's a safety mitigation. They go on, since they are aircraft, they must comply with all civil 14 CFR rules in place. That means the civil UAS must be certified by the FAA as airworthy. Currently, the industry and FAA standards to make that determination are not yet fixed. This, along with many other integration problems yet to be solved, makes the current civil use of UAS extremely limited. Also, the operator could petition the FAA for an exemption. Tethering would help in proving to the FAA that the operator can meet an equivalent level of safety to the NAS. Well,
I'm still really impressed he got a response. I mean, this is the first FAA positive show we've had in a long time. We've got the FAA granting COAs in emergencies. We've got the FAA answering questions. So good for the FAA.
And I think the question they're answering here is not about things like tethered balloons and things like that. I think they're answering this specifically with regard to tethered UAS. In other words, something that could fly on its own, but it's just being tethered. But I don't know if this is logical.
What? Now hold on. First you wanted like directions that were plausible and people listening to them.
I know.
And now you want logic from the FAA. Boy, you are demanding tonight.
I guess I am. I'm just feeling cranky. I mean, can't we say that anything at the end of a string that anchors it to the ground is tethered? Whatever it is up there, it's tethered. So what difference does it make if that thing on the string could be flown on its own? Or directed on the string by human control.
Or break away from said string.
Right. I mean, if it's tethered, it's tethered. And, you know, if it's a drone, if it's a UAS that you could control even though it's on a string, well, I mean, you can do the same thing with a kite, right? You can control kites on strings.
Do you fly kites? Yeah.
Right. I don't know. I think the argument is kind of on shaky ground. The FAA is saying, no, if your UAS is tethered, then you are not exempt. It's still prohibited. So there you have it. That's what the FAA says. So if you are amongst those who thought you'd found a loophole, the FAA anyway doesn't consider this to be one.
So our last listener feedback, and Max, we have the best listeners.
Oh, we do.
Last week, I said, I need a battery expert. And the Jimmy Fallon video is another reason why we needed a battery expert. Well, Luke Harris wrote back to us. I've heard on your last podcast you were interested in information regarding LiPo batteries. He's been flying RC model aircraft for about 20 years. and he's just started flying electric motored aircraft. And he gave us some direct, very, very, and I think we'll put these in the show notes, rules and regulations and do's and don'ts for dealing with LiPo batteries. The first one is, when charging, never leave your battery unattended. Capital letters, never. This is the stage where if a fault is present in the battery, it could possibly catch fire. Now, if you don't believe him, you can ask our friend Parker, who tried to ignite his garage by doing this. So, and the next one is?
Never charge a battery indoors. Keep the battery in a LiPo-safe bag while charging.
Always use a balanced charger and ensure you select the correct setting on your charger that matches the battery. Avoid fast charging. The most common model charger in Australia is the Swallow charger.
And then next we have know your batteries. Purchase a battery checker that can read the total capacity of the battery as well as individual cells. Then he has some advice: when you land your model, aim to have a total charge remaining of 40%. Never fly until the battery is empty. This will lead to problems when trying to charge.
Which is interesting. We always forget that, you know, these batteries have memories. If you charge a battery, it's safe to store them in the LiPo safety bag. If the weather is not ideal for flying for around 1 month, if you plan to store your batteries for a longer period of time, discharge them to about 30 or 40%.
And then finally, any sign of puffing batteries, dispose of them immediately. They are not expensive to replace and not worth risking a fire. Dispose by dropping the battery into a bucket of salt water. So this is some great advice, and I think people who have experience, as Luke does, with RC aircraft, electric ones, know these things. But people who are new to this electric flying vehicle world are maybe not aware of all these issues. LiPo batteries are something to be taken very, very seriously. And we want to thank Luke for helping us spread the word for the things that you want to keep in mind to keep yourself safe.
Okay, personally, it terrifies me, but what do I know? I'm only a historian who likes UAVs. So, Max, it looks like we're at that time. Boy, it goes quick.
Yeah, we want to thank you for listening to the UAV Digest. This has been episode 60. You can find us at theuavdigest.com. You can go right to the show notes for this episode at theuavdigest.com/60.
And, of course, we are social media pigs, so you can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest, Facebook.com, UAV Digest. And, of course, send us emails at feedback@theuavdigest.com. Or, of course, Max and I have our own individual addresses. If you want one of us to see it, it's max@theuavdigest.com or david@theuavdigest.com. Of course, if you listen to us on iTunes, definitely leave us a recommendation so we can continue to grow and bring you more coverage. And stream us to your phone on Stitcher.com. Likewise, send us a review there.
All right, very good. We also like to thank this episode's sponsors, Go Engineer and UAV Propulsion Tech.
And if you'd like to help us out, you could go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/theuavdigest, or a shortcut would be go to theuavdigest.com and click the donate link. We appreciate that. And of course, we've got swag. You can go to our cafe press store, the UAV Digest. So with that, I guess it's time to say goodbye until next week. Thanks, Max. And this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
This episode has been sponsored by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com.